day. For with the passing of the years he had become a thorough-going German, outwardly as well as inwardly, and Munich seemed like home to him. But the welcome that he received from his long-forsaken compatriots was so enthusiastic and so apparently genuine that he succumbed to it. For a while, it is true, he still talked of Germany, but that was but for a while. Soon he sent for his furniture and established himself on the Victoria Terrace in Christiania. A bit later, he acquired a house on the Drammensvej, opposite the Royal Gardens, a splendid, uncomfortable house filled with bad paintings, and there he wrote Little Eyolf. There, too, he passed into the shadow of his mental breakdown, and there, on May 23, 1906, he died. Little Eyolf followed the master builder after an interval of 2 years, and was destined to be followed in turn by John Gabriel Borkman and When We Dead Awaken. All four belong to what may be called the fourth and last phase of Ibsen's creative activity. To his first phase, as we all know, belong the imitative powers and dramas of his youth, and to his second period, the splendid epic plays which won him his first reputation, Brand, Peer Gynt, and Emperor and Galilean. His third phase began with A Doll's House in 1879 and ended with Hedda Gabler in 1890. It is upon this penultimate group that the playwright's present fame is based, and out of the dramas composing it has grown that structure of discipleship and imitation which stands as the visible symbol of the Ibsen influence today. Whether or not the four plays of his last period, in the days to come, will make a like mark upon the dramaturgy of the world is a problem beyond solution. It is enough to say of them that the first two, in more than one way, represent a step forward, that in the true sense both belong to the drama of the future. The last two are more elusive, and, judged by present standards, less important. Of the natural history of Little Eyolf we know next to nothing. Edmund Gosse, in his biography of Ibsen, suggests that the dramatist got his idea for the play from Leo Tolstoy's The Kreutzer Sonata, which appeared in 1889. When I ventured to ask Ibsen whether there was anything in this, says Gosse, he was displeased and stoutly denied it. The biographer makes the sage observation that what an author denies is not always evidence. But in this case we can afford to take Ibsen's word, for the resemblance between the drama and the novel is far from close. Indeed, as Count Prozer somewhere remarks, the last act of Little Eyolf, with its picture of love purified and transfigured, is an effective answer to Tolstoy's extravagant criticism of the marital bond. Another critic, this time a Dane, suggests that Ibsen borrowed from a play called The Balcony by Gunnar Heiberg, one of his disciples. But here again it is best to believe slowly. The Balcony was published in 1894, probably after the actual writing of Little Eyolf was far advanced, and certainly long after the plan of the play had taken form in Ibsen's mind. For he was not a facile worker, and his ideas were ever tardy in crystallizing. In The Balcony there was a heroine jealous of her husband's life work, and loud in her demands that his wooing be without ceasing. And in Little Eyolf there was the same insatiable woman. Both plays, again, gave glimpses of the grosser side of love, and so an uproar from the idealists followed the appearance of each. But further than this, the coincidence fails to do service. One is reminded here of the efforts of many a laboring critic to prove Shakespeare's debt to this and that forgotten one. In Little Eyolf, as in A Doll's House, Ghosts, Hedda Gabler, and other plays before it, marriage is Ibsen's theme. Marriage, that is, as civilization has burdened it and complicated it. In the days of Tubal Cain, a man bought a wife, and that was the end of it. No clashes of discordant personalities came afterward to cause disquiet. The man got food for the household, and the woman cooked it and bore children. Neither was troubled by a variance between the yearnings of temperament and the demands of duty. Much the same simplicity is to be found in the more elemental sort of fiction today, and also perhaps among the more elemental classes of human.